music be the food of love, play on. Totally clear, yes? Orsino wants to nourish love, he feels love, blah, blah, blah. Give me excess of it. Okay, that's pretty clear too. But then he gets into the meaning of excess and surfeiting. Does he really... So the surfeiter is the appetite, or is Orsino the surfeiter? You know, and it's just, it's a rabbit hole, that speech. Yes, it's only
a canvas. Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And joining us today is Grant Goodman. Hello, Grant.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to speak with you.
Great to speak with you.
Grant Goodman is an actor, director, and voiceover artist who's been working professionally for the past 19 years. Grant's many stage appearances include appearances at the Theater for a New Audience in New York City, Yale Repertory Theater, the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, the Old Globe, Arizona Theater Company, the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, and many, many more. Grant is currently appearing as Orsino in Twelfth Night at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. Grant, when does that show open?
Oh, we open, let's see, I think July 2nd, right before the 4th.
So you're a familiar face to audiences in Utah, but you are a true theater gypsy. You work all over the country. Where do you call home?
That's an excellent question that I don't have an answer to. I am a true vagabond. I've been homeless, as 'twere, for the last 4 years, actually. My fiance and I put our stuff in storage knowing that we had work for a year, and it turned into 4 years, which is good to have work, but I truly am a gypsy. I feel like I should have a trunk and open it up and perform like a roving minstrel or something.
Grant, that's really, really remarkable. I know many, many actors who perform all over the country in repertory theater are based out of New York or Chicago or Los Angeles. They typically have a place to go between gigs, but you've been working continuously for the past 4 years.
I have, and I've lived in New York and Chicago both, and I'm luckily at that point in my career where I don't have to be anywhere in particular in order to get work and to work. It's really a blessing.
How do you get a typical gig? Does the phone ring for you, or do you still go on auditions or video auditions? How do you get work?
Well, I have to say I've been very lucky lately where the phone has just rung and I've been getting job offers. I do still audition, which is good, but the last few years it's been work through people that I've known and built contacts through over the years. So.
Well, I know a lot of our listeners would like to know how to get to that point in their career. Do you have any advice?
I don't. I've been so lucky. You know, actually, coming here to the Utah Shakespeare Festival has been sort of a hub for me. I remember I was doing a production of Antony and Cleopatra in New York at a Theater for New Audience, and I got my first offer to come out here and play Petruchio, and I asked a buddy of mine, what do you think? Should I take this offer? And he said, absolutely. He said, I can actually trace back every job I've had in the last 8 years to the Utah Shakespeare Festival. And I can almost say that myself now, that almost every job I've gotten has come out of here. The great thing about a festival like this, or like Oregon Shakes or any of the other great Shakespeare festivals across the country, is not only are you doing the shows that you're in, but you're exposed to so many other directors, casting directors, while you're out here, and they get to see your work, and luckily that's led to other work. Work begets work.
Grant, let's talk a little Twelfth Night. You're playing Orsino.
I am. It's my first Twelfth Night, and I'm so excited to get into it.
This is the first time that you've played Orsino on stage, but certainly you must be familiar with the role.
I am, and I've wanted to play it for so long. I've auditioned for it a few times, and I've really wanted to attack it because it's a challenge for an actor to sort of balance the emotional depth that he has with sort of the over-the-top Milos Gloriosus sort of element.
Yes, it's big. It's, of course, a very challenging role. And traditionally, well, depending on the production, the words that Orsino speaks at the top of Act 1, Scene 1, may in fact be the first words that are spoken in the play. Is that the case in this production?
It is indeed. The play is starting with the storm, as a lot of productions do. And we did toy with Viola starting the play with What Country Friends Is This?
Well, this is, of course, one of the most oft-quoted opening lines of any of Shakespeare's plays, If Music Be the Food of Love, Play On. But it's also probably one of the most misunderstood because the quote usually ends before you have the full context of the line.
That's so true. And I think that oftentimes people try to play the meaning of the first verse throughout and miss the rest of the richness.
The rest of the sentence, of course, changes the meaning of the line entirely. So what is this initial sentiment, do you think?
You know, I think that he actually wants to purge himself. All of his language is sort of wanting to be so satiated that he is able to rid himself of this sort of consumption. You see these languid, wallowing Orsinos very often, and I don't think that's it. I think he's active. I think he's trying to shake it. You know, he's either in withdrawal or he's in ecstasy, you know?
Well, you know, here's a huge challenge, and you can contrast it with Angelo in Measure for Measure. Angelo and Orsino are, you know, bitten by the same bug, right?
But
we're introduced to Angelo as a level-headed, calculating, and very competent person who we subsequently learn is Orsino. Mm. Orsino is that, right?
Right.
But we're introduced to Orsino when he is not in that frame of mind. We're introduced to Orsino in extremis.
Right.
But the audience has nothing to compare it to. So the audience's first impression of Orsino is someone vastly different from who he's expected to be in the rest of the play.
Which you don't get to see him be, really, until the fifth act.
Exactly. Right. So that seems to come out of nowhere.
The trickiest thing, I think, about the role is, and this is what people say so many times after seeing it, but why would this perfect example of womanhood in Viola, this smart, independent, fierce woman, fall in love with this dum-dum? And so, well, I think the only opportunity you really have is that great scene 2-4 for you to see she's already fallen in love with him because she comes out and says so. And so 2-4 is the only opportunity for an audience to say, oh, I see why she would like this guy.
Well, you know, you take care of a lot of that with casting, because if you look like Grant Goodman, the audience takes for granted why she's...
Well, I think that there's something interesting about him. He's got all this language about the old times, and it's this old-fashioned song that he wants to hear, and you know, he's an old-fashioned guy, you know, and he doesn't like the brisk and giddy pace of times, you know. Right. He doesn't sort of like the way the world's changed, and I think that there's something that she sees in him that she appreciates, his the truthfulness of his romanticism, you know. And I think that if you play the idea of the romantic, then, you know, you're done before you start.
So we know that these lines that we're about to hear are the first lines of the play, but perhaps you can provide some additional context for us. Who is Orsino, and who is he speaking to in these first moments?
Well, that's an interesting thing, too. He's speaking to Curio and the band, and I think that's one of the interesting things that sort of has been a way in for me for this role, is Orsino is surrounded by yes men. And in comparison to Olivia, who has Festi, who is very much the truth teller in the play, Orsino doesn't have anybody telling him the truth in the play. No, he doesn't have anybody holding up the mirror to him.
So some basic information about Orsino and who he is. He is a person of some considerable power in this land of Illyria.
Absolutely. He's the duke. He's very good at being a duke. He's quite a level-headed ruler. He's just not level-headed when it comes to love.
He's got this Achilles heel, and this Achilles heel, of course, is Olivia.
Olivia is a countess, and, you know, in our production, we're setting it very much, the sea is very present, it's very on the coast. Our production is going to be sort of a modern Balkan setting. For me, I've got a very clear idea of Olivia and Orsino having this sort of West Egg, East Egg relationship.
Oh.
She lives across the bay, and you know, she is a woman of note, and I believe that they, of course, know each other. They're both from powerful families. But you don't get any idea, unfortunately, of Orsino's past or of his family. And I think that you know, any time when characters are missing in Shakespeare, that's a big clue. What is his sense of loss? What is his sense of isolation?
Great question. I love that starting point.
So here we have the Duke Orsino, lonely in his heart and lovesick for the Countess Olivia, who is, as you picture it, across the bay, right, somewhere hidden behind a green light, perhaps.
Exactly.
And the play begins. There's a storm, a shift of scene, and we open up with Orsino, and he speaks these words from Twelfth Night, Act 1, Scene 1. This is Grant Goodman.
If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that surfeiting, the appetite may sicken and so die. That strain, again, it had a dying fall. Oh, it came o'er my ears like the sweet sound that breathes upon a bank of violets, stealing and giving odor. Enough, no more! 'Tis not so sweet now as it was before. Oh, spirit of love, how quick and fresh art thou, that, notwithstanding thy capacity, receiveth as the sea. Naught enters there of what validity and pitch soe'er, but falls into abatement and low price, even in a minute. So full of shapes is fancy, that it alone is high fantastical.
Beautiful speech, Grant. Thank you.
The first thing I want to observe is how the muscularity of the verse that you bring to it, it's just terrific. And I think that has a lot to do with keywording. The choices of words that you're choosing to, what I would call spin, are terrific. It makes such sense of the speech.
The first thing that struck me about Orsino's language was, of course, he is a poet. He is a lover. And his verse is very regular. But the interesting thing is it's immaculately regular. It's not boring or staid regularity. It's perfectly regular, but it's so efficient and melodic. And there is a muscularity to his language that I think is a clue into his hyperactive imagination and his obsessive compulsive nature.
You're not particularly married to any particular recitation.
You know, I've had the great good fortune of doing a lot of Shakespeare, 50-some-odd productions, and I think as you get to know it better, you have more confidence with trusting the verse. My director for Hamlet, Sean Patrick Riley, who's a great actor, he's an American actor, but he was lucky enough to spend some time with the RSC, and he actually played Hamlet for John Barton, which was daunting for me to be directed by someone who had played Hamlet for John Barton.
Mm-hmm.
But as you can imagine. But he said to me that John Barton told him that, you know, even Laurence Olivier took 20 years to learn how to ride the text and to really just sort of jump onto the text, ride it like a wave, and see where it takes you. And I'm certainly not there yet, but knowing that that might be the goal and that that might be something that it takes you a very long time to acquire is inspiring.
There are some specific areas where, well, you might say there are challenges of the text or maybe some opportunities to make specific choices that jump out at one reading the text. And one of them occurs in our line 7, which is where a mid-line ending occurs, stealing and giving odor. And then the line continues with enough, no more. Could you give some insight into what sort of choices that presents to you, the actor, and what guides your choice in the moment?
I can. It is really a fielder's choice in that instant, and it will sort of boil down to how we want to play that. I always believe that one should try to keep the verse line intact as much as possible. So it does sort of depend on where the music is cued. If the music comes in at that strain again, it had a dying fall, with Orsino demanding that particular piece of music that he had heard, if it comes in there, then you can keep that verse line intact because the music's been playing, and as he's speaking the line about the violets, it can be in his ear and he can immediately jump to, no, that's enough, I don't want to hear it anymore. Or you can break that line, which I don't necessarily like to do, which is after stealing and giving odor, you can have a moment to take it in and realize he can't take it anymore. At any rate, it is a very quick shift in his psyche, and he's got a few of those. It's nothing like the language of Leontes in Winter's Tale, where he has one of those every three lines.
And it's a great example of Shakespeare's verse mimicking what's going on in the character's head. But it's also a mixed metaphor, which I also think is indicative of what's going on with Orsino. I mean, he talks about sound and aroma.
It's a beautiful image. And it's right, he does mix his metaphors. Whether that's on purpose or not, I don't know. But so there are a lot of great drowning imagery in the play. They're all drowning in something, whether it's mourning for Olivia, whether it's love or lovesickness for Orsino, whether it's in mourning for Viola, whether it's actual drink for Sir Toby, whether it's in self-love and officiousness with Malvolio. All the characters are drowning, and a lot of great drowning imagery in the play.
And that brings us to the image of the sea that Orsino brings up, and the extended image from lines 9 to 14 that starts with, O spirit of love, how quick and fresh art thou.
Can you parse that metaphor for us, Grant? It's very, very involved imagery with layer upon layer. For example, when it continues on to line 14, so full of shapes is fancy that it alone is high fantastical. Can you sort of untangle that?
I'd be a better man than many Shakespearean scholars, if I could. it is so tricky because it is a bit like a rabbit hole image. First of all, I think that this is the first moment where he has a real sense of self-awareness about sort of how ridiculous he is or how lost or adrift that he is, because he's very aware of how tricky, how changeable love is. It's difficult to trace, is he speaking to the spirit of love? Is he speaking to Cupid when he's talking about the capacity of the sea? Is he likening Cupid's love to the size of the sea?
Or is he comparing one person's love to is minuscule in comparison to, it's very confusing.
Or is he at a loss? I think there are fun instances in Shakespeare where the characters just lose control of the language. I'm thinking of one in Much Ado where, now I can't remember whether it's Benedict or Beatrice who says something along the lines of, it were as strange a thing as that which I know not.
Yeah.
It's possible, again, that he gets ahead of himself there. Who knows? But it's comforting to know that an actor of your stature and experience, Grant, could be as flummoxed as the rest of us when it comes to parsing the particular meaning of these lines. Now, at the risk of becoming completely wonkish, and which we do for the benefit of listeners who delight in this sort of wonkishness as much as we do, but it's certainly not to be pedantic. But line 14, in particular, the first clause of line 14,
it's an Alexandrine.
Is it? I don't agree. See, here Jim and I had a spirited discussion about line 14 when we were analyzing it, about how it parses with the meter.
Right. Now, is fancy set sort of aside, it stands alone.
It seems to, but I'm of the opinion that there's an opportunity there to elide that first clause in two places so that the meter of the second half is regular.
So that een becomes een, almost?
Yes, and even minute becomes one syllable.
Right.
It seems to me that gives an opportunity to let the tempo be reflective of the sentiment.
Sort of. If you do that, then it sort of leaps you into the next thought, doesn't it?
Well, I think so, but Jim is of an opposite opinion. Not to put words in your mouth, Jim, but what's your feeling about that line?
I have trouble sometimes trying to cram a line like this into the 10 beats, but I agree with what you're saying, is it really highlights so full of shapes is fancy. But I do think that even in a minute finishes the previous thought, and I think you need to give it a little bit more time than the elision that you're referring to.
Well, now that you said that, Jim, you're bringing me around to your point of view. It's nice to have these brain children about these lines, but if the audience can't understand what you're saying, then it's irrelevant anyway, isn't it?
The two of you are like the psychomachia of me. Good angel, bad angel. I'm both, I don't know who's good and who's bad. But I have been of both thoughts the whole time, and I've played with both of them. There's something to me when you have a 12-beat line that makes those last two stick out in space in such a way that they do sort of stand alone. And I believe that Shakespeare must have been doing that for a reason. It's always interesting to do a word bubble of a character or do a word count of the words that your character says. I remember when I was playing Macbeth, it was interesting. I did a word count and Macbeth says the word ambition once and the word fear something like 40 times.
Wow.
And I thought that was such an interesting insight to that character.
That's extraordinary, because you'd think that it would be the opposite.
I think so. And that's why with Orsino, I think he says the word fancy, at least 10 times. Some of your listeners will have to do a word check on me on that. But
there you go.
So when that sort of stands alone like that, I think that you can, sometimes I think you can elide a line like that. But for me right now, I think I'm sinking into it, and as Orsino would, languishing in that 12-beat line.
Grant, you've appeared in 50 or more Shakespearean productions.
I have. I was counting the other day. I think it's either 53 or 54 now.
Now that puts you within reach of a particular ambition that you set for yourself. What is
well,
that?
Well, I certainly would like to before my bucket list is to complete the entire canon before I shuffle off this mortal coil.
That's to appear in every one of Shakespeare's plays.
That's correct, yeah.
How far along are you?
Well, I think I'm at 30 right now.
So that leaves how close. Many?
I've got 8 to go, depending on who you trust, which plays Shakespeare wrote. And I've got some of those obscure ones, like Two Noble Kinsmen.
Wow.
Which is wonderful. And I've done a production of Pericles, which is more and more popular. It's a fantastic play, and I'm glad to have been able to do both of those. And actually, Twelfth Night is my first Twelfth Night. I've done so many plays, you know, 4 and 5 times.
So, Grant, what counts as being in a play? Is it a full-out production, or what about a staged reading?
Well, I'm going to count full productions. And,
meaning something you get paid for?
Quote-unquote, staged parsley.
Staged parsley. I haven't heard that. I've heard Spirit Carrier.
I haven't done Titus. I haven't done a Richard III. I haven't done a Troilus and Cressida. So those are on the list. And I've never done a King John or a Henry VIII. So
those are tough. Those last two.
Well, they're doing King John and Henry VIII this season at the Stratford Festival outside of Toronto, Canada.
So
there's an opportunity to at least see those. But since you're not Canadian, you missed out on, on that. Grant Goodman, where and when can our listeners see your work on stage next?
Well, I'll be here at the Utah Shakespeare Festival from July 2nd until October 25th. I'm playing Orsino in Twelfth Night and Colonel Brandon in Sense and Sensibility. But then in the fall season, we continue Twelfth Night all the way through the fall. And then we add a couple of shows, Sherlock Holmes and Boeing Boeing. And I'll be playing Bernard in Boeing Boeing in the fall alongside Orsino in Twelfth Night.
Wow, that's a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today, Grant. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you guys both so much. It's been fun.
Grant, this has been a delight. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for listening to The State of Shakespeare. Without
your love. Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening. Just as phony as it is.